You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Mel Kendrick. Mel, thanks so much for being with us today.
Great to be here.
Let's talk about what you're working on now. What's happening in your studio, or what are you prepared for at the moment or working on?
Well, I have a show in October, and that seems to be coming around pretty quickly, so I'm kind of busy working on a couple of different things, different bodies of work. What I have in my studio in New York, which is mostly the small scale or wood pieces, and then I also have a warehouse space upstate where I'm working on some larger pieces that are going to be precast concrete. And I'm not quite sure how the show is going together. I just am working, basically.
And where will that show be?
That'll be at David Nolan Gallery, 29th Street, Chelsea, in Manhattan.
And it'll be a solo show and a mixture of works, or will it be all cast works, do you think?
Well, that's a difference of opinion. I have an idea, and these things usually resolve themselves. I have an idea, or recently had an idea of how I want the show to look, and then it's not really what the gallery had in mind, but that will be resolved. It'll be a mixture of work, but I always think that a show is pretty much a statement. I like it to be somehow unified in some way, not kind of a little bit of this, a little bit of that. So that's my main thing, doing a lot of different things and, finding my way through to see which way it's going to go.
And when you talk about a statement, do you mean formally in a dressing form or aesthetic issues, essentially?
Well, I guess they're aesthetic issues, but they're all my issues. I've worked with a number of materials over the time, and I, look back at different shows as being, fairly, cohesive. My first show at David Nolan back in, 2005 or so, was red blocks, and everything was, based on these red blocks of wood. Then the different show. My show at Mary Boone a couple of years ago was called Jacks, and they were all related large concrete pieces, black and white stripes. And my last show at David Nolan about 2 years ago was water drawings, and they were basically drawings that I had made working with a Dudonnet papermaking place, and I was working with making molds and casting paper and pigment. It just kind of unified. That's all I really mean.
So let's move through some of those shows. I mean, if we can go as far back as, Boston days, you can go as far back as you want, but when did you first get involved in the art? You can go as far as being a kid or just when you got out of school, but what was the point where...
I've always said that I think that a lot of that, permission is very... when I graduated from college, 71, it was very hard to call yourself an artist. There weren't any artists. You didn't know any artists. We weren't aware of, artists out there making a living off of it, completely different than now. So a lot of it was just, defining yourself. How do you define yourself? And I came right to New York City because that was, where... people were. I read Art Forum. I read all the, art magazines, and I sort of fixated on New York. So I came here when I was 23 and, basically been working here since. But it was a different...
What happened when you arrived in New York? Yeah, completely. And what was it like when you arrived in New York then at 23? What did you do, or what did you look
well,
for?
Well,
I think
I went to graduate school because I needed a crutch. I couldn't... this whole thing, I couldn't arrive and declare myself, and I went, Hunter College, which was, incredibly inexpensive at that time. I think my master's cost like $1,500, but anyway, I arrived, and, there was Robert Morris and Tony Smith and various people teaching at Hunter, you know, the minimal artists, and I wanted to, meet them, study with them. So I went there, and, you know, and there they were. It was all so accessible. It was kind of immediate, very, very exciting. And
right, I've heard Tony Smith was a great teacher.
Oh yeah, Tony became a great friend. He was a great teacher, and you know they're very interesting classes. I mean, it's all almost more philosophy. I mean, he was, you know, called himself, he was an architect, a painter, a sculptor, and we very rarely sat in front of an object and talked about it. Like I can barely remember that. We brought them in, although, you know, the class at that point there were no studios at Hunter, so we moved from apartments to people's lofts, and people brought work, and we'd have the work there, and we'd have, you know, the beer or whatever, and, you know, we were around the work, but we very rarely did any direct criticism. It was more like, what did it remind Tony of, and that was far more interesting than the work in front of us, so that's the way it went.
And then what happened after that? It sounds like that gave you that kind of, if I'm correct in understanding the sort of permission or the identity as being an artist?
That was slow coming, I guess. I mean, it was still an idea, but there was no viable, I mean, I didn't know. I assumed I'd be doing construction work, you know, pretty much forever, which is what I was doing. You know, odd jobs, drove a taxi, that sort of thing. But no, there wasn't the way into the art world at that point was through these new not-for-profit spaces. Like, you know, there was, the Drawing Center opened, the Artist Space, PS1. And so that was like the exposure one was trying to get. Because the art world, you know, the Castellis and all that, there weren't that many galleries, and they were all, you know, seemed like the space was occupied by the, you know, the minimalist, post-minimalist conceptual artists, and it was very hard to get to think about being involved there. It wasn't like galleries were running around looking for young artists. It was quite the opposite, actually.
And how did you find your first gallery or first exhibits? I guess they were at the Drawing Center. Was one of your first shows in the city?
Well, my first show I worked briefly as an assistant for Dorothea Rockburn, and this new place was starting called Artist Space, and it was a tremendous gallery on Worcester Street at that point. It was upstairs from Paula Cooper, beautiful space, and there. Modus operandi was to ask known artists to recommend younger unknown artists. So that was actually the first place I showed, one-person show, basically. I mean, there are three big rooms, three shows. And that was the first thing. But I often, you know, just in terms of what's going on now, I was in New York 10 years before I sold anything. This is all just about, you know, making art and being in the community, really, and getting to know other artists, and then
right.
You know,
well, yeah. And of course, the nonprofits weren't selling work. Also,
the nonprofits were nonprofit, yeah,
right,
for everybody, yeah.
And so you're making work and really learning, I guess, I'm just meeting more of the community of New York and then the network of them.
But I had a sort of a leg up when I was working for Dorothea. It was like she was on the cover of Art Forum, and it was like really big. And I traveled with her, and I'm trying to think what year it was, probably spring of 73, summer, and did all sorts of, you know, shows from San Francisco Museum, Kent State, Washington, Listen Gallery, London, you know, went to Spoleto Festival, Documenta, Biennale. I mean, it was an amazing trip. And so during that time, I got to meet not every other artist I'd heard of, the ones that I hadn't met already in New York. So, you know, that was kind of a really exciting time.
That does sound like an exciting time. And so maybe we are 10 years later when you've arrived in New York. where was it that you first sold work, and how did that happen?
God, I can't even remember when I first, you know, I mean, sold work was, I remember when I didn't sell work, but the other thing was selling work. My first one-person show with the gallery was John Weber Gallery, and that was 1980. But, you know, I have to say something about the nonprofit spaces is they were reviewed, they were written about. It wasn't like you were in obscurity, you know that it was really kind of a very active scene. So, again, it's all, you know, it's what everybody bemoans now. I'm sure there's a community somewhere, but this was one art community that, you know, hung out at Max's Kansas City and all that. So that was, you know, pretty much as involved. And what I always used to say is that you just went to openings, and then after the openings, you went to parties. And you got to know people. And then it was just a question of whether, you know, people were interested in your work and your decision, you know, should I be showing, thinking about showing, am I ready? We're kind of like very cautious, I think, you know, in terms of this definition of being an artist or not. And so, you know, it's kind of a waiting game until you pretty much said, what the hell? You know,
well, that's interesting.
Work.
Cautious also about the idea of what it means to be ready, right, to have enough work or work that you feel good enough about it. Is that kind of what being ready?
Yeah, it's funny. I don't hear it much now, but there's actually people thinking, you know, you could make a mistake. You know, you could show your work too early. You could, you know, not be ready and not, you know, and then you were kind of damned if you, you know, screwed up or something. I think it was overly, you know, neurotic, but that there was, people thought about it that way. And it is true. I mean, you know, as Andy Warhol said, would you want to sell your work at Woolworth's or Tiffany's? I mean, you were waiting for somebody, you know, you wanted somebody important to like your work, and you wanted to get that audience. So, but the ready, yeah, the ready is more of an internal thing. I think that it was kind of a game, and people would, you know, say, oh yeah, what are you doing? Say, oh, I'm working on something. Pretty much the same thing I still do. But, and then, you know, hopefully, you know, the right time comes to show it.
Right. I mean, that's still common, you know, among artists. I hear that a lot from writers, and it's always kind of funny with writers. You know, what are you doing? I'm working on a novel, you know. What's the novel about? Well, you know, you could say anything, and you could be working on that novel for years.
Right. And I think some people make it sound more interesting than it is, and others do just the opposite. So, yeah.
And so then we're maybe moving through the 80s. Was there a time when you stopped doing construction and were able to become a full-time artist, which I know wasn't a goal then, but it suddenly happened to you? Or didn't
well, it, hap- it it actually happened. I mean, the 80s, you know, were kind of incredible in any number of ways, you know, and forces were out there. I always refer to, like, you know, the bad painting show at the New Museum. There was a kind of a break. Because of all those artists I mentioned, I was sort of focused on the generation ahead of me, and I, you know, forget when it was, but, like, you know, like David Sally, Eric Fischel, people arrived from outside, you know, and were doing different work. And so everything was sort of tossed up in the air, and I think that's a large part, you know, of what was going on in the 80s. And, you know, and it was good for me, too. I guess 1983, my show with John Weber was, you know, one of those amazing experiences where there was I guess Vivian Rainer wrote a review. I was thinking about the show. I thought it was really good. I was feeling like, oh, I'm about to give up, you know, though I can't. If nobody buys anything, I'll give these pieces to all my friends. And then the last day of the show, it got this rave review and picture in the New York Times, and that Saturday everything was, you know, sold, and it was just a big turnaround. So that was kind of amazing, and that started, you know, my 80s, my experience of the 80s. And from that point, then I showed in Los Angeles with Margot Levin and various places. So So that, yeah, the 80s were, you know, pretty exciting.
That is exciting. And I suppose you were ready for that at that time. I mean, you know, I mean, I knew you were, but there's artists also that were in positions maybe not quite similar to yours, but suddenly when work was being sold, they stepped back, or, you know, there was self-destruction or other things. Not every artist, even who was talented, it seems, could receive that influx of money and the potential to do this full-time.
Yeah. It's not coming to mind who it hurt. Money, it's like, the Renaissance. Anytime there's that, and probably now, to, you know, people say that, but, you know, that there is, you want an audience. I mean, what does an artist want, really? You want to be in the conversation. You want your work to be seen. That was happening. And then, you know, if the work was selling, all the better. So then you could make more work. You could just, you know, basically, invest in yourself and focus. And, so that was, I can't say I didn't have to think about much, but I was working. But until much, much later, I would say 1985 was my most successful year for quite a while. That's sort of like when everything was happening. I was showing, you know, in the both posts and all that.
And so now we're in the 90s, 2000s. It's your work's matured. You're having more shows. And is that when your studio expanded and you were upstate and began to have assistance?
Things always keep changing. I had a family. I was involved with that, and then along came, 9/11, and a lot of different pressures were going on then. So, it's kind of a little dodgy there for a few years, and then I moved my studio, actually, because I'd been down Tribeca and realized that I really couldn't afford having a studio there because it was so valuable. So I turned it into an apartment and ultimately wound up with a studio on the Lower East Side, East 9th Street. But it was, changes were taking place. And, all I can say is, I'm doing more work now than, I've done in years. So that's kind of great.
That is great. And East 9th Street around that time, I was living on East 10th Street, but East 9th Street around that time, there was other artists in that neighborhood, wasn't there?
Yeah, there were. Gracie Mansion, I think, was in this building. There definitely are. There's that whole very brief moment of the Lower East Side galleries, which were great. I mean, they were open on Sunday, and I showed there with International with Monument, which was, one of the great galleries there. It was a very short time phrase, but yeah, that's the East Village started opening up. I would probably say that almost for the first 15 years in New York, I never went east of Avenue A. But I'm sitting there now. I'm on Avenue D, so.
Right. That used to be a pretty dangerous area, but now there's beautiful French cafes there.
No, that's too much. I always liked the in-between stage. The in-between stage was good when I could leave my truck double parked on the street all day and never get a ticket, and now it's completely. It's gentrification follows you around wherever you go. I'm not here at night. I still don't live in my studio, so it's still a great place.
And so now you're making more work than ever. You're saying this is you're really in a mature stride you're producing a lot.
Yeah, well, the one thing that changed is I'd been showing with David Nolan, and then I did a project at Madison Park. 2009, 2010, and they had it in mind that, maybe I'd want to do a project there, and that's where I developed, going through a lot of different options, developed this idea of precast concrete, which you know, was pretty exciting to me, a different way of working, where I'd actually make the molds and then have them cast at a you know, whatever fabricator, and black and white layers of concrete, kind of like you know, the Sienese or whatever, the black and white marble in the Italian churches of the whatever, the Gothic Renaissance, pre-Renaissance. But anyway, the black and white,
like that, like not the Carrara marble, but
I'm just blanking on which. I know that the cathedral in Siena, I think sometimes it's called the Pisa style of black and white.
Right.
It always fascinated me because, you know, there'd be entire architectural motifs and then these black and white stripes would just plow right through them as if they had nothing to do with them. So anyway, kind of I did that, those pieces, and that just, you know, led on to other things. The large pieces I did with Mary Boone in her gallery, which was, you know, such a great space, the one on 26th Street, for these large sculptures. And yeah, and so that's basically why I have a space upstate, because these pieces can weigh, you know, whatever, 7-10 tons. So it's a completely different thing than the way I work in my studio in New York.
I know. I think that would be, you know, incredibly complex in terms of just the logistics of moving things like that, isn't it? Hard to get them across certain bridges and everything. How do you move work like that?
Well, they aren't that heavy. My first observation, and I'm sort of changing it, was, oh, it's actually easier to ship, you know, whatever, a 10-ton sculpture on a flatbed, because they're moving all over the place, than shipping a painting in a climatized, you know, crated, you know, box, whatever, across the country. There's a system out there. There are a lot of heavy things being moved around the country, and so this just happens to be sculpture. So the moving's not that hard. Installation's a little difficult, but, you know,
right.
The methods are there. Yeah.
Well, that's exciting, and that's most of the work that I know of yours. So the next show that's coming up, you have dates for that, and where this interview will be about?
October 22nd is the date of the show. But I also just, I mean, when I say the interesting thing of working in these really, you know, large pieces is they're sort of, you know, they're two things going at once, and just last week I installed two large pieces from the Markers series in Chicago on the waterfront, and that's pretty great. So more people, you know, when you do public art, many more people see it than will find their way to a show in Chelsea. So,
well, the scale is also, you know, heroic, right? It's monumental.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that also must be an incredible feeling, you know. I mean, it's like when you first make work larger than yourself, and I know a lot of your work always was pretty large, but that big, I don't even know if it's, maybe heroic isn't quite the right name. It's almost kind of...
Well, it's something. I think part of the reason I called the first ones Markers was because they were like, you know, tall markers, you know, black and white, attention-getting devices. Just to go back to the whole public art thing, is that was a revelation to me, because thousands of people go by and you see people standing there looking at, you know, people would never go in a museum. So I think I kind of steered clear of it before because, you know, I want to do my own work, my own ideas, and galleries let me do that. But then I sort of found that same, you know, freedom in, you know, working larger. And so that's what I'm doing a lot of at the moment.
That's exciting. So your studio upstate must be huge.
Yeah, it just happens to be, as I say, it's a forklift ride away from my fabricators. It's just a commercial space, which I rented a large area that is very close to the people working on these pieces. So, you know, things can move back and forth very easily. And, yeah, and, you know, it's still pretty empty, which is great. for working.
Well, Mel, it's really been a pleasure talking to you. I look forward to seeing your show in the fall. I will be there, and I hope
Great.
The listeners will be too. Thanks again for talking with me today.
Okay, well, thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.